Welcome to She Thinks, a podcast where you're allowed to think for yourself. I'm your host, Beverly Hallberg. And on today's episode, I'm honored to have on three Hong Kong freedom fighters who have made it their life's work to stand up to the Chinese Communist Party and fight for basic human rights in Hong Kong. Due to their work, all three have been accused of, quote, inciting secession and, quote, collusion with foreign forces, and currently have $1 million bounties on their heads. So we're going to discuss the state of Hong Kong, their work, and even recent legislation that has struck a blow to the partial autonomy Hong Kong had been promised by China. So before we get into the conversation, I want to give you a little bit more information on the three ladies joining us today. First of all, Frances Hui is the Policy and Advocacy Coordinator for this Committee for Freedom in Hong Kong Foundation, which works with communities oppressed by the CCP. Anna Kwok is the Executive Director of the Hong Kong Democracy Council, a leading nonpartisan nonprofit organization for Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement and Hong Kongers in the United States. Joey Hsu is a Hong Kong activist and executive council member of the World Liberty Congress. She played a vital role during Hong Kong's pro-democracy protest in 2019 as a student leader organizing on campus and citywide protests. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us on She Thinks. And want to get into a lot of the details, but just to state some other details that are helpful for our audience to know. So all three of you have had to flee Hong Kong. You're based in Washington, D.C. I know that there are bounties on your heads. First of all, do you feel safe? Are you safe? Before we get into this discussion, just want to see how you all are doing.
Well, I can just start off sharing a little bit. I think, as you said, three of us have bounties on our head issued by the government. And I think personally, this is like okay for us like to kind of feel safe. But I think the extension of, transnational repression by the CCP is really hard to predict. And we have seen in the past that dissidents have been hunted down by the CCP in sort of different avenues. And, before the bounty was issued, many of us have experienced receiving harassment and death threat. And personally, it's been going not only online, but also physically. And in one of my cases, it was being investigated by the DOJ. And we see that happening a lot in the community and happening not just on prominent figures like prominent activists, but also to people in our own community that are only, advocating for the movement anonymously. All of us have experienced cyber attack and harassments as such. So I can't say that we feel completely safe, but it's also something that we need to flag to the international community, to the governments here. It's an issue that we need to really nail down to and get to addressing and, studying and trying to fix here in the U.S.
And do you feel like the United States, the government, you mentioned the DOJ, do you feel like the government has stepped up and helped you in the ways that you needed to be helped?
I definitely think that the U.S. government, the FBI, they're all aware of what transnational repression is and what this bounty means to us on a daily life. But at the same time, I think because this is such a new concept for a lot of people, even though this has been happening for decades, I would say. So there are definitely still mechanisms lacking in place that can actually help us. So, for example, last November, I was in San Francisco protesting against Xi Jinping because he was in town to have his bilateral talk with President Biden. And during that time, actually, there were many instances of being stalked, being tailed, being followed by people. And some Tibetan activists actually also got beaten up. And still, we could see that, the response from the government and from local law enforcement have been limited because they are basically not equipped with the right skills to really treat these issues. So what we're doing right now is really trying to amp up the public discussion. So thank you so much for having us, because I think it's really important to get it into people's knowledge that these things are happening on American soil as well.
Absolutely. And I think also when we look at some of the border issues that we're having, there's been a lot of reports about a lot of Chinese nationals coming across into the United States. I'm assuming that's a concern for you all as well, correct?
Anyone want to talk about it? We probably would just stay away from domestic political issue, I think, for three of us.
Okay.
Yeah, but I can quickly address, you know, transnational repression, as both Francis and Anna have been saying, it is happening in so many forms within our communities, in the Tibetan community, in the Uyghur community, in the forms of, you know, community infiltration, coercion of activists, you know, detaining our loved ones or bringing them into interrogations back home to deter us from continuing our activism overseas. And I think especially for us as being, you know, female activists in the space, beyond the death threats and also cyber attacks and disinformation campaigns that have been orchestrated by the Chinese Communist Party all across social media platforms. I think the three of us have also experienced pretty brutal, you know, gender-based political violence coming from all sorts of state-affiliated actors attacking us for our activism based on our, you know, appearances, based on how we conduct ourselves in public events, based on the way we talk, we dress, et cetera, et cetera. And that is something that I think really worth the world's attention when it comes to, you know, thinking about the issue of transnational repression. I think specifically for all those communities attacked and impacted, specifically within our communities, the marginalized groups within our communities are the ones that are even suffering so much more from these kind of transnational repression. And I think that is something that is very much worth our attention as well.
Yeah, and I want to take a step back and talk about the situation in Hong Kong and what has brought you all to where you are today and fighting for just basic human rights of Hong Kongers. And that is the British handover of Hong Kong to China, which began in 1997. And there was supposed to be 50 years of self-government and freedom. But there's been this slow erosion of freedoms that has definitely escalated to the state that you find yourselves today. Would any one of you just want to share what Hong Kong was like prior to China really trying to take over Hong Kong and what it's like today?
I can jump on first. So I think one very vivid example, just to show everyone the contrast of difference, is that this Saturday, Article 23 will be passing. And Article 23 is a legislation, a law that essentially will expand the legal ground for the government to pursue more political, arbitrary political arrests on Hong Kongers inside of Hong Kong and abroad. And the same legislation actually was introduced 22 years ago in 2002. When the government wanted to pursue this law back then, half a million of Hong Kongers marched on the streets of Hong Kong in 2003 and successfully actually at the time to oppose the bill and to stop the government from proceeding with the bill. But just 36 hours ago, the bill passed the Legislative Council in Hong Kong with no objection. And I think that has just come to show, you know, how much Hong Kong's freedom of expression and political freedoms, et cetera, have really deteriorated. And of course, I think we can confidently assert that Hong Kong never really had true and authentic democracy because we never had universal suffrage and we were never really governed by our own people or people who could represent our voices. But still, we could see that Hong Kong was supposedly on the path to true democracy, but now we're nowhere close to democracy, and we can even be put into jail by fighting for democracy. And that is just how Hong Kong has changed in the last two decades.
And Anna, to follow up on that, I know that this piece of legislation will take effect next week on March 23rd. What are some of the major changes that people in Hong Kong are going to see based on China once again taking more of the autonomy away from Hong Kong? What does that mean practically for people?
I definitely think that it means more censorship for a lot of Hong Kong people because they can be criminalized for saying the tiniest political thing and political expression. And one important element of this article is also the extraterritorial implications for Hong Kongers and also for foreigners actually as well, who happen to be in Hong Kong and who happen to have some sort of connections to Hong Kong. So now the Hong Kong government is really introducing the Chinese style national security framework to go after foreigners who look like they're espionage, and also to go after Hong Kongers, even though they reside abroad. And that's also, you know, part of an extension of the bounties we're receiving, right? The bounties we're receiving are all on work we have done outside of Hong Kong, outside of the territory of Hong Kong, but just by virtue of us having Hong Kong citizenship, which actually, by the way, is going to be repealed, you know, sometime later, I would imagine. They are, you know, claiming they have the rights to criminal are definitely peaceful activities here advocating for Hong Kong. So that's just some implications I can imagine. I'm sure Joey and Francis also would have some personal observations they have.
Yeah, well, Joey, I want to come to you on this and just talk to you a little bit about what it was like when there were those demonstrations and how people feel today. We look at this piece of legislation that was passed. It was unanimous, but of course, we know that there's a lot of pressure, and the political leaders that are put in are very friendly towards China and Xi Jinping. What is really the morale of people in Hong Kong from when the demonstrators started to where you all are today?
Yeah, I think it's for sure definitely very, very different. You know, I grew up in Hong Kong where every morning I would read newspaper and then watching news where you could still see, you know, legislators of different camps debating on different social issues. But then eventually Hong Kong after 2019 become this place where even the June 4 Tiananmen Massacre candlelight vigil in Victoria's Park, which is held on an annual basis, where people from all across the world come to Hong Kong to participate, is banned. And then all these pro-democracy media outlets, independent media outlets, are being forced to cease operations with all of our, you know, very, very prominent leading pro-democracy activists, and then the anonymous protesters who were participating in peaceful demonstrations and rallies have been put into jail for allegedly violating the national security law that came into force in Hong Kong in 2020. As Anna have said, for the most trivial political acts that they have done, including, you know, hanging up a banner or posting a poster that says, you know, free Hong Kong. So definitely the situation in Hong Kong has been very, very different. And we do see that with Article 23 being implemented in Hong Kong and coming into effect this Saturday, that will further, you know, bring a crackdown to the civil society of Hong Kong, to the people in Hong Kong. Of course, I can say that people in Hong Kong are very terrified of the Article 23, but I think something that the international society, the international community must also acknowledge is that even though with such a draconian, such a harsh legislation being implemented in Hong Kong, so many Hong Kongers are still persisting, they're still resisting, you know, very hard in any possible ways that they can. They are still, you know, organizing anonymously. They're still, you know, trying to increase their own capacities to survive in such a dire situation, trying to organize themselves, trying to learn more, and really to pass on that spirit of our revolution that happened in 2019 or even before that. So I think with that kind of hope, with that many people who are still inside of Hong Kong still clinging onto the hope, I think that is also serves as a reminder to us who are overseas. Obviously, we have the bounty on our heads. The situation is not easy for sure, but with that kind of hope, I'm sure that all of us would still try very, very hard, try very, very best to persist even with the national security law and Article 23.
And Joey, I know that you spent so much time working with young people with the protests. As I mentioned in the bio, you were a student leader organizing on campus and citywide protests. Are those protests still going on today? I'm assuming as things get stricter and stricter, it's more and more dangerous. Do we see any protests today?
Unfortunately, after the national security law that came into place and with the Article 23 that is coming into effect, we don't see any kinds of, you know, large-scale political demonstrations happening in Hong Kong in the foreseeable future. You know, when people are getting arrested for distributing pamphlets on the streets, when people are getting arrested for hanging up banners that says Free Hong Kong and for participating in a democratically organized primary elections, you cannot expect the people to, you know, again, come onto the streets. But as I have said, I think a lot of Hong Kongers who are still on the ground and overseas are still persisting, resisting. It's just that we have turned that momentum that we have built from the movement in 2019. We're no longer turning them into large demonstrations and protests. We're turning them into many creative ways of, you know, resisting in a more low profile manner to be able to pass on that spirit.
Yeah, and Frances, I want to come to you on this and talking about the resistance and what you all are doing in your work. You're all very active in this, obviously. That's why you have the bounty on your head. What does the work look like now? And where do you think your work can help Hong Kong? Some people may look at this and say it's a hopeless situation. It's just going to look exactly like China before too long. What do you say to that?
Well, I think Joey and Anna touched on the, you know, the notion of feeling, you know, keeping the hope. And I think all three of us, it's now, you know, out of Hong Kong, and we're sort of away the most persecuted area of, you know, advocating for Hong Kong. And so I personally felt that there is some, you know, more of his responsibility to speak up with the space that I have. We are in a free country, obviously not a safe place still for three of us, but I think we're trying to use what we have and the resources and, you know, the platforms that we have to speak up for those who are oppressed in Hong Kong. They're not voiceless. And as Joey said, they continue to stay in their own sphere and to speak up using their own method. And, you know, there are still resistance on the ground. And but I think for us, it's our position to use our platform, our resources to kind of amplify their resistance and to tell the international community that there are ways that we can help to kind of sustain the space, the limited space in Hong Kong, and especially to, you know, raise profiles of those who are currently in prison. You know, there are so many courageous women, political prisoners in Hong Kong who are, you know, locked behind bars and continuing to speak up. An example of it is Chow Hung Tong. During the public consultation of Article 23, she herself wrote a submission to the Hong Kong government to oppose the bill. And we're talking about her still kind of, you know, staying behind bars and, you know, not a completely free environment, but she continued to use her own legal expertise and knowledge to speak on these issues. And I think that's just, you know, kind of embodies the courage and the bravery of a lot of the women and, you know, a lot of the female activists that we know in this human rights space, and also all of the other 1,700 political prisoners in Hong Kong. I think all we are trying to do here is to advocate for them and to raise their profiles and to, you know, advocate for their release. Although it feels very difficult, but I think we are trying our best to do this and to make sure that the world do not forget about Hong Kong and try to find different ways to tackle what's going on in Hong Kong and, you know, the oppressor, which is the Chinese Communist Party. I think also, you know, with what we're here doing, it's also a part of a way to send a message back to Hong Kong to tell the people that there are still a lot of our friends are still out there to try to do our best and to keep the discussion going. And so it could also send a really encouraging message to a lot of them who are currently in Hong Kong, you know, living a life and trying to make their voice heard.
And Frances, I just want to follow up on what you just said there. You talked about the female political prisoners that are in Hong Kong. And I think we've seen when there have been certain demonstrations or uprisings, whether it's in Hong Kong, whether it's in China, whether it's in Iran, you see women seeming to lead these demonstrations. Did you see a lot of women, maybe more women than men, being part of these demonstrations? And what does that say about women right now who are making these types of stands? Anything that you've noticed based on your experience?
I think it's interesting that there are actually a lot of women in this human rights space. And a lot of times you see a very strong resistance and persistence for specific values and We're talking about human rights and freedom and democracy and humanitarian issues. I think it just talks, there's some reason that women are in this space and we continue to resist and persist. But I think also, you know, it talks about the difficulties and challenges of being women in this space is that sometimes we do need to take extra efforts to make our case. And I think it's stronger when women come together to support each other in these kind of work and to make sure that we are in a safe space kind of influencing and encouraging more young girls to join our movements. I think that's very important for, you know, having the representation of women in these, environment and continue to, I think what we're trying to do is to use our voice and to speak up and tell other people that, you know, you can also do this and, you know, to show that female and girls can also take part in you know, leadership and in activism.
And Anna, I want to come to you on this just to follow up on that. And I think some people may be listening right now, first of all, think that you all are so brave and applaud the work that you're doing and saying, what can I do to help? For those who do want to support the cause, support the women who are political prisoners right now in Hong Kong, what do you typically tell people when they ask how they can be of help?
Definitely. So if you're an audience based in the United States, we actually have several legislations and bills in Congress right now that need a lot of supporting. And they include the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office Certification Act, as well as the Hong Kong Sanctions Act. And these bills actually try to hold the Hong Kong government accountable and try to also stop the Hong Kong government from having an outpost here in the United States to spread their propaganda and even, you know, to surveil on people like us. And besides that, I think it's also important to just, you know, follow our organizations, follow our work and amplify our work when you're able to, because a lot of the times you try to raise profile of political prisoners back in Hong Kong, we try to gather support for prisoners to get, you know, better treatment in the prisons of Hong Kong. And sometimes really public attention can make a difference. If their names are unknown, if their cases go unknown, then everything can happen in the dark. Whatever you can imagine can happen in the dark. But once they're out in the open, once these cases are known, these names, these faces are recognized, then the treatments can sometimes be a bit better. So I think it's also important for people to recognize, even though we are arguably in a very hopeless and helpless state right now in Hong Kong, it's also important to not think of it as, you know, the end of Hong Kong. Even though we are at a very low spot in Hong Kong's history, I do think that, you know, there are still possibilities for change. And that change comes from the world banding together, democracies banding together against authoritarianism, against global authoritarianism on the rise. So it's important to support our cause, and please do, you know, follow our work and amplify our work, and do look into the bills that I've mentioned, because that would really make a change in how we can see the Hong Kong movement going forward.
And before we go, I want to give you each an opportunity to talk about how people can follow your work. And I'm going to go ahead and start with you. Where can people find your work?
You can follow us, the Hong Kong Democracy Council, and also my personal account on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So we try to keep Hong Kong's cases updated every single day. And we also try to have call to actions, such as the legislations I mentioned, that we need public support on.
And Joey, where can people find you?
I am also on different social media platforms, including Instagram and Twitter. Our organization, the World Liberty Congress, which collects and also amplifies the voices of human rights activists and also advocates from all across the world, including Hong Kong, Tibet, and East Turkestan. We're also available on different social media platforms. And just wanted to add to what Anna have said, I think one very simple thing that all of you in the audience can do is to just take 5 or 10 minutes out of your every day to write a letter letter to the political prisoners who are still inside of Hong Kong now, a letter might seem very, very simple and very, very maybe not as helpful as the advocacy that we could do on a, you know, congressional level. However, by writing a letter, you're letting them know that the world has not forgotten about you, have not forgotten about the Hong Kong political prisoners who are currently in jail because of their human rights activism, because of their bravery and courage standing up for Hong Kong. So I do encourage you all to follow our work on social media, but then also more importantly, to take actions to, you know, as Yanev said, to advocate with us for the legislations that are in Congress and Parliament right now, to write a letter to political prisoners who are still in Hong Kong, retweet something about them, tweet something about them, post about them. So, yeah.
Great. And Frances, I want to go ahead and end with you. Where can people find you, and any final thoughts?
Yeah, if I can dwell into back into what Anna and Joey just said, you know, a few days ago is Political Prisoners Awareness Day. And we talk about political prisoners a lot. Joey just mentioned writing a letter. Actually, I know HADC has like a political prisoner database that record documents, like kind of keeping track of like the numbers of political prisoners in Hong Kong. And for us, the Committee for Freedom in Hong Kong Foundation, we also run a separate database that details all of these prisoners' profiles. So on it, you can find people like Chow Hung Tong and Gwyneth Ho, their background, their story, very detailed things about, you know, what their position, their title, but also some of it include the mailing address, which you can use and to write the letter like what Joey's just advocate for. We do encourage people to use that information to learn about the stories, you know, the stories behind all these people, because oftentimes we look at a number and we don't actually know who these people are. And by understanding and learning about their background and their story, it can really be empowering and also help us to understand and educate ourselves why they decided to take on that path. And, you know, use that information to write a letter to them. I think that's also very important. So it's on the cfhk.org. So thecfhk.org. That's our website, but we're also on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, like every other organizations are. And obviously, I'm personally on all these platforms too. So please do follow our work and support us in however way you can.
Yeah, I am really glad to hear about the database and that people can go on and write a letter, hopefully serving as some encouragement to those who are behind bars because of their activism. And we thank you all so much for joining us. We pray for your safety, of course, and we applaud the work that you're doing, Frances Hui, Anna Kwok, and Joey Su. Thank you all so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you
for having us.
And thank you all for joining us. Before you go, IWF does want you to know that we rely on the generosity of supporters like you. An investment in IWF fuels our efforts to enhance freedom, opportunity, and well-being for all Americans. So please consider making a small donation to IWF by visiting iwf.org/donate. That is iwf.org/donate. Last, if you enjoyed this episode of She Thinks, do leave us a rating or a review on iTunes. It does help. And we'd love it if you shared this episode so your friends can know where they can find more She Thinks. From all of us here at IWF, thanks for watching.